With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our first Hall of Fame podcast of 2016 for the 2017 Hall of Fame. I'm joined by Grand Prix editor Mark Hughes on my left and Karen Chantock. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Now, I mentioned the Hall of Fame. We've got lots of modern Formula One to discuss. We've got loads of readers' questions. But just to explain briefly what we're going to be doing later, we need to pick a new shortlist for everyone to vote on. And this year, quite rightly, Sid Watkins won everyone's votes in the F1 category. And we need to come up with a new list of 12 people for the public to vote on. We have some really confusing rules. That's why we've had to actually write names on the board, like a school classroom. So we'll come to that in a bit. And we have Jack Phillips here to help us with the board. It is quite confusing. We are confused about it. So hopefully we emerge in an hour's time with a really exciting list of people to vote on. For now, though, let's talk modern Formula One. Mark, I'm going to come straight to you with all the current news. Formula One's been sold? It hasn't been sold? What's going on?
It's in the process of being sold, I believe. Yeah, everything's pointing to that. It's going to be in two tranches. The first one will be next week, and we're expecting it to be completed by the end of the year. So Liberty Media essentially taking over as the majority shareholder.
So they're buying CVC's share?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah, and Bernie's?
There's all sorts of detail and that's not known yet, and what Bernie's role is exactly going to be. You'll certainly be there in a transitional period, despite what you might have heard elsewhere. I don't think it's even been decided what the long-term position is there.
Some people have said it's, you know, there's a certain amount of elation in the paddock, I guess, because CVC has been seen as a company that's made a lot of money out of Formula One and not necessarily given a lot back. Surely we're just going to be, I mean, Liberty Media is buying Formula One for the same reasons as CVC did 10 years ago. I mean, it's a vehicle to make money, isn't it?
It's buying it to make money, but hopefully it's going to have a different model in that it will be an owner who is going to invest in it and take a long-term view of it rather than a private equity company who doesn't operate in that way. They're approaching it for quite a different direction, and hopefully that change will be one for the better in terms of the health of the sport.
Okay, Karen, if you had all the money at your disposal, would you have bought Formula One or a share in it?
Oh, that's a big question. Really.
Sorry, I could start off with a sort of a massa question.
I start with a nice beach house in the Caribbean, but I think, you know, if you're looking from a pure financial standpoint, CVC have done exceedingly well out of it. It's been one of the, you know, really more profitable investments, I think, if you look at the last decade. So from their standpoint, you know, they're quid's in. If you look at it from Liberty standpoint, now I suppose the study needs to be, has it reached its peak in terms of revenue generation, in terms of valuation, or, you know, is there a potential for it to go further on? I think the key difference between a CVC and someone like Liberty is Liberty are a media group. Yes, of course, it's a vehicle to make money and they're in it to make money. But I think I'd be really interested to see what they do with the sport in terms of how they, you know, embrace online and embrace new media, and also what they do with future, you know, TV and radio deals, and you know, how will they impact, you know, the price of tickets, for example, for the people in the grandstands? Will they reduce the rights fees? You know, there are so many things, but I think possibly the most important and the biggest issue for Formula One is how they negotiate the terms with the teams, because you have to have the teams to have a sport, and really we all know there are several contracts coming up in 2020. Mark could probably, you know, elaborate on how many, but I think that most of them are 2020, aren't they?
Apart from Renault.
So, you know, that's a key point, is how, you know, how do you get Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull with both their teams, McLaren, Honda, you know, all these people to commit to Formula One to safeguard the future of the sport. And for me, that's a very key point of whoever takes over.
So on the current timescale, we could see changes, quite big changes, as of next year, or is that too?
I mean, only in terms of ownership, not in terms of the format of the sport. How do you mean?
No, as in the way the Formula One media is used in terms of YouTube, social media, because MotoGP does a brilliant job, yeah. And Formula One is, I mean, my humble opinion, is not particularly good at it.
But I don't think it's something that we're going to see overnight. You know, again, I believe that this is a process that will take a bit of time. You know, keep in mind everything I've just said about Liberty as a media group, there are existing contracts in play. You know, for example, Channel 4 or Sky or Rai Italia, whoever, you know, they've got X rights to put things online, and you know, there are certain clauses within the contract that restrict other people from doing things on the internet and within certain territories. So, you know, I think there are several layers upon layers and contracts upon contracts that mean that we're not going to see changes done, you know, by Singapore or even by next season. I think, you know, these things all have to play out over a slightly longer period of time.
Contracts, everyone's favourite thing. One contract that is coming to an end, Felipe Massa is stepping down from the sport. Mark, what are your... You wrote a lovely piece for the Motorsport website on him. He's been a great asset to Formula One, hasn't he? And he would have been a very worthy 2008 world champion.
Yeah, for me, he was the worthy champion of 2008. He was denied it through the Renault team's subversion of Singapore, basically, because Felipe was walking that race and lost all his points as a result of what happened there. He had a retirement whilst leading late in the race in Hungary. He made mistakes that year, but they're both the title contenders did. Lewis did too. For me, he was a more rounded performance over the season, and I think that will stand, you know, is the high point of his career. A lovely guy, came in sort of quite a raw rookie, very, very spectacular. And that sort of, now he's still, even when he became a seasoned pro, he's still really interesting to watch, because, like, quite ragged with the car, and the car's always moving about. He's always pushing and then sort of coming back. And yeah, he's been a great asset to the Williams team since joining them in 2014. He's brought a lot of experience there and was still quick. It's only sort of the last year really that Bottas has consistently got the upper hand over him. I think it's about the right time for him, I think, to step down. But I think, yeah, great career, one he can be proud of.
So amazing as well to come back from the accident that he had in Hungary, because did he come back too soon from that? Because he wasn't quite the same driver afterwards, I didn't think, for a certain period of time.
It's hard to tell. I think any period of time out of the sport and out of the car, you know, you lose that last little bit that you need in qualifying. You know, I don't think Raikkonen's come back as quick as he was when he left, you know. And I think you know, having time away is difficult. So I wouldn't, you know, I'm not a medical expert to decide whether it was based on his injury or just based on time away. But I think Mark hit the nail on the head. I think he can be very proud of his career. He's done an excellent job and been a good ambassador for the sport.
And another of the elder statesmen who's not retiring, who's on a sabbatical, Jenson Button. Is this just a convenient way for McLaren to get three into two?
It's partly that, but it also works for both sides, or it works for all parties. It means that McLaren get Jensen's appeal with the sponsors, and he's able to help along with the development program, the car on the sims and stuff like that. But it keeps Jensen involved, and that's what he really wants. And Jensen's not ready to retire yet, so this keeps that option alive. The team has an option on him as a race driver for 18, and we don't know yet what Fernando Alonso is going to do at the end of his contract, the end of 17. So it's not impossible. We might see him racing again for McLaren in 18. He'd be 38 by then, so you know, maybe not, but who knows. But yeah, it keeps Jensen involved, which is what he wanted, and he's still a major asset commercially for McLaren.
Is him getting a 2018 race seat really dependent on whether Alonso continues? Because I mean, it's either that or Van Dorn is not up to standard, but I think everyone knows he will be. So,
well, the Formula One market moves very quickly, doesn't it? You know, who knows what's going to happen at the end of 17? You know, is Kimi going to be around? Ferrari going to buy Ricciardo out of the contract? What's Verstappen going to do? You know, it's so difficult to try and plan that far in advance. I agree with Mark. It, from a commercial standpoint, has worked really well for McLaren, this arrangement. My understanding is that if they didn't take up their option on Van Dorn, you know, at this point of time in the last couple of weeks, they may have lost him. And if you were McLaren, I don't think you would want to risk that, because I think Van Dorn is something very special. So, you know, what happens down the line for Jensen in 18 is something we can only look at after 17. You know, Fernando might get to the first four flyaways next year and think, you know what, I've had enough, and he might go. So, you know, it's just Formula One is just a constantly moving target, and you have to watch the market accordingly.
I would love to see Alonso at Le Mans in a proper works team. I think it'd be really exciting, but hopefully he has more years left him in Formula One. We mentioned him there. Max Verstappen. Mark, I might be wrong, but I remember you writing a piece online a while ago when Max first came in, saying if he's good enough, he's old enough, and he's definitely good enough. Have you changed opinion at all since Belgian Grand Prix, or
no,
the same rules apply?
No, not at all. I don't think what we saw at the Belgian Grand Prix was really a product of his age. I think it's... we're seeing similar moves from Michael Schumacher well into his 30s, you know, even second time around, if you think back to that move he put on Barrichello, yeah. So, no, I think it's coming from a different place from that. The concern about his youth was whether he'd be, you know, he'd be crashing into people and misjudging things. That was what the perception was, that he wasn't experienced enough to race safely. He's shown that he's a Grand Prix winner. He's one of the top guys out there. It's just a question of now how the Formula One community deals with the issue that his interpretation of the regulations has brought up, because there isn't a regulation specifically prohibiting the way he handled Kimi's attack in Spa. So how... That he's interpreting it to the letter, and
so that's why the stewards didn't pick it up then, because there wasn't a rule that written down that he'd actually.
Yeah, although it's since been Charlie's pondered that maybe he should have got a black and white warning flag, because there is a cover all rule that you could do, that you shouldn't endanger the life of another driver.
Karen, what were your thoughts when you watched that live?
I thought it was on the limit, but we've seen worse. And normally if you see worse, they end up in accidents. So I think if he'd moved a fraction later, if he'd moved half a second later, you risked an accident. So I do think it was very much on the limit. Actually, David Coulthard and I watched an onboard of the Schumacher versus Hakkinen incident there, 2000. And actually, Michael moved to the right and carried on moving right much more than Max did. And in that instance, Mika actually carried on later than Kimi. Kimi backed out of it earlier. So, you know, arguably, as Mark said, we have seen worse, and they haven't hit, you know, Mika and Michael. So I thought it was on the limit. But, you know, that's what he's there to do. You know, he's there to stay ahead of the other car and do everything he can within the letter of the law, and then argue the toss later on, as long as they don't have a massive massive accident.
I do think it's down to the stewards to come down very hard on that, though, because it shouldn't be a matter of varying interpretations of etiquette. I think if you make a really strong ruling on it when you have the chance to, like they did at Spa, then it takes any ambiguity out of the question in the heat of the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that he hasn't been brought up in front of the stewards or anything means that it's not an invitation to do the same again, but it's not a great example to younger drivers.
It's still not being resolved.
Yeah, I mean, there are too many grey areas when it comes to driving etiquette and driving standards. And it's now, if you look at it, you know, the stewards have set various precedents along the way. I mean, the classic being the four wheels over the white line track limits thing, you know, having different rules at different corners. It's just massively complicated things. Things like, you know, Fernando's release from the pit box in Spa. Was it or was it not an unsafe release? You know, again, there's so many things which are, they've opened up grey areas. On the flip side, I do sympathise. I had a long conversation with Tom Christensen at Monza, who was the driver steward there. And I do sympathise, because every incident that they need to look at is different. The circumstances are different, the speeds are different, the circuit is different. So you do have to take it case by case. And unless you have the same three stewards going to every race, you're never going to get the consistency. You know, if three of us went to three, you know, looked at an incident in three different rooms, we'd all have a different opinion on it. So the system, in a way, is flawed, because, you know, it's a subjective matter you're asking to judge, and you're asking different people to judge it every time. It's a solution to pay professionally, hire three or four stewards as full-time permanent people, and that is their only job, perhaps. But at the moment, you know, these are volunteers, technically, who are coming to do the races.
I mean, it's the same in lots of sports, though. You know, how many times have you watched a football match or a rugby match and, you know, been shouting at the TV because of a decision the referee's made? You know, I guess it's a part of sport.
But it's evolving, isn't it? It's evolving. You look at, you know, in cricket, you've got Hawkeye. In tennis, now they use the technology, don't they, where they have X number of appeals per set and all that stuff. So, you know, I think that every other sport is evolving. And so is Formula One. But I think the complexities of Formula One far outweigh any other sport. And therefore, the way decision-making happens and the rule-making happens has to evolve at a faster rate.
Now, we've got lots of readers' questions here, so I'm going to dive into them. They jump around quite a lot, as is their nature. But there's a nice one here from Jamie Smith, especially in light of your new role at Williams. Of all the historic cars you've driven, which one has made you wish you had actually driven it in period?
The FW14B from 1992, the Mansell car. You know, that whole active suspension program, I would have loved to be involved with it. I just read the car manual has come out for it, and I just
I've got it on the shelf at home.
Yeah, I've just read it, and then I had a chance to chat to Paddy Lowe about it, and the poor chap ran away from me in the airport lounge, I think, at the end. But I just think that's a fascinating program. I think the 15C is my sort of favorite of the Williams cars. but the 14B. But I haven't yet driven the Mansell 87 car, and I think that'll be pretty special, the Honda Turbo as well.
There's actually another one from Jamie here about how a Formula E car compares with conventional race cars with regard to feedback and feel. Does it feel the same once you're strapped in and pushing the boundaries, or is it a completely different experience?
In some sense, it's the same because you've got two pedals, a steering wheel, and four wheels. So you know you drive it like a normal car. In another sense, it's completely different because the torque delivery is obviously instant. You know, you have to use the electronics to manage the torque delivery rather than really your right foot, because it's a switch. It's binary in some ways. The lack of sound is weird. You know, your first three or four laps. I remember we were at Donington. I came out the pit lane and went down the crane of curves, and all you could hear was this, whoosh, whoosh, you know, the wind noise, and that was just weird. And it was a wet day, I remember. And all of a sudden, actually, as a driver, you've lost one of your senses. You know, you forget how much you rely on sound. To, for example, when the back of the car starts to step out of line, you forget how much you rely on the sound to modulate the throttle and control the oversteer. And all of a sudden, that's gone away. So you soon get used to it, and you rely on, you know, your sight and your bump to feel which way the car is sliding. But it is a bit tricky. The trickiest part I found was the way the energy recovery system works. You know, unlike in modern sports cars or Formula One, you know, it's not, they don't have brake by wire systems. The electronics aren't as sophisticated. So, you know, you've got this manual wind up brake balance adjuster like you would in a Formula Ford, but you sometimes have to alter the brake balance up to 8-10% depending on the amount of recovery. So it's a very complicated car to drive. Probably, you know, it's not very quick, obviously, especially in race mode, but in terms of complication to drive, it's probably the trickiest car I've ever driven.
Blimey. There's one here from at Bring Out the Sun. There we go.
It's been a pretty good summer.
It has, yeah. Bring out the sun. The sun is out. I'll point this at you, Mark. It is a question that could have an hour-long answer or more, but I could just sort of condense it down a little bit. I think Sir Stirling Moss is the best of them all. Don't you agree?
Well, I don't disagree, but that's not the same as agreeing, is it? Yeah, it's totally subjective. He's one of the all-time greats. Okay.
Karen, I'll throw that over to you, because I think that it was aimed at both of you. Stirling Moss, the greatest of all time.
I mean,
the easiest question I've ever asked.
It's so impossible to compare. You know, unless you've got them all in the same day, in the same car, on the same tires, the same fuel, I hate answering questions like that, because I think it's so subjective. Every person has a different opinion.
Okay, so you don't disagree?
No, of course not. But okay. You know, you can make a case for anybody, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, for most people in your Hall of Fame
list. I would love to hear you make a case for me.
I think you could say that from the period of Fangio's retirement until Moss's own retirement through injury, he probably had a bigger margin of advantage over the whoever was the next best than anyone subsequently or before.
To bring out the sun, I hope that's answered your questions. There's one here, where was it? Yes, it's something that came in via Twitter. Mark, I'll come to you first. Do you think the pecking order is going to be changed drastically next year when the new regs come in, with the wider tyres, more downforce?
Yeah, I think one thing it'll definitely do, two things, one good, one not so good. The not so good is that we'll spread the gap between the front and the back of the field. I think you'll see an initially bigger spread. But in terms of will it mix it up at the front, I think there are grounds to hope so. Yeah, you're starting with a clean sheet. You're not doing little iterative developments on something that's already the best and trying to keep it the best. I would hope both Red Bull and... McLaren, I'm expecting a big jump from McLaren, from the Honda. Ferrari, not so sure about, because they're in a bit of disarray. But yeah, I would hope that the Merck are going to get a bit of a tougher time than they've had for the last 3 years. I certainly hope so.
I'll just do a few more of these, and then we'll move on to the murky waters of our Hall of Fame rules and regulations. Karen, one for you here from Kevin Joyce. What, in your opinion, did Caterham Team Lotus fail to do in order to stay on the grid? He says, for example, John Booth, Graham Lydon were the core of Manor and Marussia, and they were there through the toughest of times and were helped by the likes of Ferrari. Could Caterham and Lotus have done more to stay?
The whole team was a really odd setup. Looking back in hindsight and speaking to, they had a lot of good people, but also had a lot of not so good people who were earning a lot of money. And I think in many ways what happened was it became quite political. You know, it had all the politics of a big team without actually being a big team, and it started to get messy and really. People started pulling in different directions, with particularly with the aero and development, and it just wasn't run as efficiently as as the lean mean back of the grid team needed to be. There were a lot of things that when you're a startup team, the people joining you need to sort of recognize that you're a startup team, and in many instances they were. Because they, for whatever reason, decided to base themselves out in Norfolk, and they had to spend a lot of money getting, first of all, Hingham up and running. Then they spent a lot of money moving to Leafield. I was good friends with Tony, and, yes, we had a bit of a fallout in 2011 about the Indian GP, but, we sorted things out, and since then, I get on with him well. But, I remember him telling me they paid a lot of people across the board almost compensation sort of figure, a higher salary to leave the teams in Motorsport Valley, whether it was Williams or Force India or Enstone or Mercedes, whatever, people from that part of the country. They had to pay them £5,000-£10,000 more to move to Norfolk. And then they had to pay a relocation fee to move them all back to Leafield again, And that's what I was saying. That was just one example of in many. I think there were a lot of instances where the it wasn't quite managed in the way that it should have done as a lean, efficient race team at the back of the grid.
Is it a very hard team when it's like that to go in and drive for them, or can you actually shut all that out and get on with the job at hand, or have you always got this kind of all the politics and the rubbish, I guess, in the back of your mind?
In hindsight, it didn't work out for me, and I think in one of the reasons was there were certain key people, without naming names, certain key people in the management structure who just didn't want me to be there, and they made life quite difficult. From day one, it was very much, he's just here to drive a bit on the Fridays. I had a contract to do a certain number of races that wasn't fulfilled, and all of that became messy towards the end. But it wasn't a pleasant atmosphere for me personally. The engineers were great. Jody Eggington is now Toro Rosso, who was sort of chief engineer at the time. He was always really supportive, and Tim Wright now works with Sergio Perez. There were a lot of, as I said, good people who've gone on to work with other good people. Graham Watson is a team manager that has now gone to Toro Rosso. And, these were all really good, supportive people. But there were a lot of others who were, not as pleasant to deal with.
Right, another question from this is from Jamie Smith again. Actually, it's just a bit further down. I know Karen has a great knowledge of our sports history, and was wondering if he had any thoughts on Francois Severt at all. I'm a big fan of his, although I'm not sure why. He died the year before I was born. And then a follow up to that: does Karen have any motorsport heroes?
Obviously Severt was the next man coming. And I think Jackie had a really put his arm around him and groomed him in a way that I can't think of any other drivers who've done that. You could argue Schumacher helped Massa out a little bit in the early days, but I don't think there was ever a driver of Jackie's stature or as successful as him who actually thought, you are my protege and I am going to hold your hand and teach you everything I know because I'm going to retire and you will be my legacy. Obviously, was very quick. Jackie recognized that. A real shame that he didn't get to fulfill that potential. As far as my heroes, I always grew up as a Prost fan, and I always thought our sport is unique. We've got a position where, as drivers, you rely on technology for the ultimate result. You don't have that in tennis. You know, Federer's and Nadal's rackets are pretty much the same. You don't have it in cricket. You don't have it in football. You know, it's a unique sport. And I thought Prost's approach, where he went about trying to get the car to do the work for him and have this minimalist approach in his driving style, putting as little energy as possible into the car. I thought it was just still quick, still incredibly quick. I was a big fan of that. But I think people like Mario Andretti is another one of my big heroes, because I think the ability to get into anything and win, whether it was IndyCar, NASCAR, midgets, Formula One, of course, and all sorts. Big Mario fan.
And he's still going, driving the two-seater, indeed, now. It's whatever age he is.
And still flat out. I mean, Dario Franchitti was telling me, you just can't slow him down. He says, you just get in, and he's just flat out. He's a bit of a liability soon.
Mark, what's your thoughts on Seva? He was the up-and-coming man, as Karen said.
Yeah, I mean, he came in very inexperienced, actually, in 1970. He wasn't probably really ready. It was a short-notice thing, because Servo Gavin had got an eye injury and just retired because he couldn't drive quickly anymore. And Seva had engaged Stewart in a Formula 2 Dice earlier in the season. And he looked good. He looked like, he was definitely one of the most promising of that generation, but he was very, very light on experience. But there was no great pressure put on him, and he said at the time that, Ken Tyrrell was great. He said, we don't expect you to be quick, just get the hang of it. And he wasn't particularly quick at first, but he developed. Won his first Grand Prix in 71, but even after that, his 72 season is a long way off Stewart. And it was only in 73 that it all started to properly come together. But the margin he was off Jackie initially, you wouldn't keep the drive now. You would be sacked before the season ended.
What a change that there's been. If you're not, imagine a team owner, imagine Christian Horner or Helmut Marko coming into a Red Bull Junior and saying, well, you don't need to be quick. Just don't crash the thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, Kvyat lost the Red Bull drive because he was about a quarter of a second off Ricciard on average. Francois' first season against Jackie, you're not comparing like with like Jackie had the better engines and everything like that, but it's probably about 10 times that.
Yeah, it's a different world, isn't it? Mm. Right, a final question. Again, another big question that we could probably talk about for days rather than sort of a few minutes. This is from Luke Guilfoyle. I think I've pronounced that right. Hi, Karen. A massive fan of yours. I just want to know your thoughts on how... that's Luke speaking, by the way. But I'm a big fan as well. I just want to know what your thoughts are on how Formula One should be run as a business, a dictatorship, a committee, an entertainment company. And this is all in light of, obviously, Bernie selling shares and everything going on there.
It's probably not the popular opinion, but I believe sport should be run by dictatorship, provided it's the right dictator. And that's a big caveat. Because I think sport, especially something like motorsport or Formula One in particular, it's very fast evolving. Things change very quickly, and you need quick decision making. Decisions by commissions and committees and boards. They'll meet once a month or once every quarter, perhaps once a year. And by that stage, the sport's already changed, And I think it's very important for the sport, any sport, to have certain key people at the top with a good advisory board around him, perhaps. So if you had an advisory board made up of Ross Brawn, Rory Byrne, someone from the engine side, someone from tires. You had four or five key technical advisors. Then you had your key commercial advisors, When I say commercial, I'm talking, from sponsorship as well as activation in terms of media and television things. So you have two elements, sporting and commercial. And you have, say, 10 people as an advisory board, but they all advise this one key dictator for using, the word from the question. But let's call it a boss. And I think that's...
More politically that, correct now.
Yeah, it's more politically correct. I think that's probably a key way to run a sport.
Is it, Mark, would you agree? I mean, I think it's what infuriates me about Formula One at the moment is someone comes up with a good idea or even a bad idea and nothing can be decided on it.
Well, the strategy group has done nothing, has it?
Well, it's just tied in knots. It's in handcuffs, effectively. It's ineffective. It's I agree essentially with what Corinne was saying. I think you do need a strong man at the head of it. And also someone with a full appreciation of all the facets, but being advised by key people. So, marketing, sporting, technical, but with an agreed vision of where it's trying to get to. What you want the sport to be, and what you don't want it to be, and also within that, how you can make a good business out of it, but without subverting the sport just to serve the needs of the business.
No easy task.
No.
Just before we go on to this, how's all the Channel 4 work going? Because you're extremely busy. As I, there isn't a race that goes by when you're not giving lots of insight and useful tips.
I'm really enjoying it. I didn't quite understand what it took when I signed up for all 21 races at the start of the year. I have to say, it's kudos to Mark and all these guys for doing it year after year. It's it's completely different when when you're driving. There's a real intensity to it, and the motivation. You don't even think about the travel. You don't even think about the time away from home, all that, because the motivation for when you're driving is totally different. When you're going there to as a broadcaster or with a magazine, it's totally different because you actually spend a lot of time hanging around waiting for something to happen and waiting for somebody to tell you something. So there's a lot more hanging around, and I think that took a little bit of getting used to. Obviously I've Channel 4 is the fifth different Formula One broadcaster I've worked with, so I've been around a little bit with various channels, but it is very different. But it's a great team of people. It's great to have Mark Webber and DC. Obviously, they're not shy of opinions, and that's not even getting started on what Eddie has to say when he rocks up. So, it is good, and so far Channel 4 have been very happy with viewership in the UK has been good. I think Sky do a fantastic job, but they're chasing a different audience. They have to create content to fill a whole channel. They're chasing a very specialist audience, and I've worked with them in the past. They do an amazing job. Channel 4 are chasing a different audience altogether, and so I think it's two separate ways of going about things and two separate shows that you need to make. And so far, the feedback has been very good.
Excellent. Right, the Hall of Fame. I will try and explain the rules, but please shout if they aren't clear, which they probably won't be. So this list here, starting with Watkins down to Andretti and then finishing at Schumacher, these are the Formula One characters, let's say, who are already in the Hall of Fame. So they're already in and they can be forgotten about, as it were, just for now. This year, Sid Watkins was voted in by the public with thousands and thousands of votes, quite rightly. So he is in the Hall of Fame as of early this year. So next year, we have this list here, which was the shortlist that we gave out for the public to vote on last year. What I'm proposing is that Cosworth, Duckworth and Costin, Gilles Villeneuve and Nigel Mansell, they finished quite close to Sid Watkins on number of votes. So I think they should go back into the pot for this year. Still with me for now?
Yeah, and I agree as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
This then is the list who got fewer votes. So what I'm proposing is that we try and change those names, so the public have a fresh set to vote on. If, however,
so we're looking for an extra 9 names, some of which might be from there and some of which aren't on the board.
Exactly. So, for example, if you are 100% certain that Alberto Ascari completely belongs in the Hall of Fame, as he might well do, then please say and state an argument. And Jack, our very able, useful assistant, will write down new suggestions here so that we don't end up with 15 names like we did last year rather than 12. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so far.
Okay. Right. The good thing about these rules is that they aren't really set in stone because we've sort of made them up as we go along. However, we have got a note here from Simon, our features editor, which I will read out, so you're going to have to bear with me for a bit, because he's written quite a lot. He's currently sitting...
Of course he has.
...waiting for... a gas engineer, so he's obviously got a bit of time on his hands.
Are you going to read it in Simon's voice?
I'll tell you what, I'll go and then start reading, because he does that every podcast. Good afternoon, gents. I'm sorry I can't join you today, but I'm at home writing about Alton Park, Prescott and Thruxton, obviously, while waiting for an engineer to sort our antiquated central heating system. I know many worthy names have yet to be admitted to the Motorsport Hall of Fame, but in Formula One terms, I believe two in particular are most conspicuously absent. In no particular order, they are Gilles Villeneuve and Nigel Mansell. I'm familiar with the age-old arguments about Villeneuve being a primate in a crash helmet, but the facts simply don't back this up. I'm not sure any other driver, with the possible exception of Tazio Nuvolari, has ever encapsulated the essence of racing as fully as Villeneuve. He was hard in combat, yes, but also scrupulously fair. I accept that he had a few accidents, but not many were his fault beyond the summer of 78, his first full F1 season, after a fledgling career away from Europe's cut and thrust. For most of his F1 career, he was saddled with ordinary cars, the exceptions being 79, when he adhered to team orders as Jody Scheckter took the title in the 312 T4, and in 82, when he died, before he'd had a chance to make the most of the 126 C2. There is more than enough evidence to underline that Villeneuve was a driver of great feel and touch, as well as raw speed. How the hell did he stick a Ferrari 126 CK on the front row at Monaco in 1981? That was a bit like qualifying a Routemaster bus in the top 6. Simon has a lot of time on his hands at the moment, and he was almost 2.5 seconds clear of teammate Pironi, who was pretty handy. And then there was his habit of taking tyre compounds more tender than Michelin recommended, yet invariably making them last. A griller, I think not. That he has but 6 Grand Prix wins to his name, as many as Ralf Schumacher, is perhaps the ultimate proof that statistics alone are a hopelessly inadequate barometer. He should be in the Hall of Fame, period. And the same applies to Nigel Mansell. Nigel might have a divisive personality, but that should not be allowed to cloud the facts. He didn't have to do a great deal of racing en route to the world title in 92, given the superiority of his Williams, but he made impressive use of the material at his disposal. And consider some of the stuff he did when he didn't have an obvious car advantage. Passing Berger around the outside of Peretalda in 1990, winning the 89 Hungarian GP from a midfield start at a circuit where you weren't supposed to be able to overtake, regularly going wheel-to-wheel with Ayrton Senna and having no apparent fear of potential consequences. Not many did that. In his prime, he was a fine, committed racer. There had been signs of that throughout his junior career, and Colin Chapman clearly saw something in him. I believe he was quite an astute judge. So there we go.
He's agreed with us, basically.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah, right, okay, on to that. Thanks, Simon. I think, obviously, funnily enough, I know some of the stats behind the scenes, and Duckworth and Costin were the second most popular in public votes.
Well, I mean, they're giants, aren't they? They're giants in terms of the engineering behind the sport, and even if they'd never done anything else other than the Cosworth DFTV, that would put them in there, because that's...
It made Formula One, didn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, totally.
Absolutely. I mean, it started the privateer Formula One era in many ways.
Yeah, it prevented it becoming just the preserve of the factories, and it gave us give it its own lifeblood, really.
What's your favourite Mansell memory then?
I mean, actually, I think it's going back to the 80s. I know he dominated in 1992, but to me, in 86 and 87, he was impressive. And I remember watching the season review earlier this year of both those seasons, and he was actually quite unlucky. He had a lot of races where he had non-finishes and reliability issues where, you know, arguably he should have won the World Championship both those years. And I think, but Silverstone 87 has got to be it.
I was lucky enough to interview Mansell the other day, and him talking about 87 was for Silverstone 87 was great. Sorry, Jack, we'll give you some names. I think, should we try and throw out some new names and also some reasons why you're putting them forward, and then we can get some new ones on the board, and then we can have a look at who we're thinking of dropping, and then so Mark, you first.
The obvious missing one from the entire board for me is Ronnie Peterson. You know, he's the probably the most spectacular driver of his era. Maybe the most spectacular we've ever seen in terms of just raw car control, but being fast at the same time. It wasn't just drama for the sake of it. He just lit up the crowd. He was in his personality was so different from the driver as well. Very quiet, self-effacing man, lovely guy by all accounts. I never met him, but know a lot of people who did know him. An inspirational character, and I think he should be on there.
I would say Nelson Piquet, three-time world champion, and incredibly intelligent, was very good at picking his moment when to switch from Brabham to Williams. Very, very quick. I think just an obvious inclusion for me. Any triple world champion must have done something right in his career.
It's odd actually that he's not on this list already. Mark, you were here last year. I mean, I think his name was mentioned, but it didn't. I mean, actually, when you look at the championships, the races he won, he should be a sort of a given,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, it's he was the enemy in the time of Mansell Mania, I suppose. So he's painted as the bad guy a bit, but it was a role he liked. I think he liked being the pantomime villain. Very smart driver, was very good technically.
And commercially. I thought he did his own deals, and he was really smart. He had all his success, up to really 87, won a few races with Benetton later on, and then realized, okay, I don't know how many years I've got left, I better start cashing in quite quickly, and negotiated some very lucrative deals to make sure he's, set up for life as well.
But he worked very hard as well. I think was it Frank Durney who told us that...
The active car, he flew back from Brazil.
Yeah, he actually flew back
test.
From Brazil just for a test. I don't know where it was, but it was a British, windy right. British circuit somewhere. You were talking about Mansell, I think he couldn't do it, and he was stuck in Jersey or something, but then Piquet flew all the way back from Brazil.
Well, that would have been an added bonus for Nelson as well, the fact that he was doing something that Nigel wasn't able to do.
I'd never thought of it like that. Yeah, you know the mind of a Formula One driver much better than me. Before we go on to some more names, are there any on this list, Hawthorn and above, who at the moment we're dropping off the list only for a year? They can come back in 2017 for 2018. But are there any on there that really jump out that you say, hang on a second, we need to keep them in?
Ben Rosemeyer, maybe the fastest driver of all time, arguably one of the fastest drivers of all time.
I thought you said Moss was.
No, that was the other guy. I just didn't disagree.
I think Fittipaldi should be in there. He was a bit of a pathbreaker for Brazilians coming over to Europe, and he was really the first. I think you can't underestimate how difficult it is to come halfway around the world from another continent and make a success of it. And the way he did it at such a young age, at a very dangerous time in motorsport, obviously made a very bad decision to go and join his brother's team later on. But
It took him 18 months to get from Formula Ford to his Formula One debut.
Exactly. It's incredible. I mean, we're all talking about Max today, but Fittipaldi was really the Max Verstappen of that time, and very quickly won his two world championships as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about this, but I think that the likes of Rosemeyer, it's harder for people to relate to them nowadays. There's really no footage of them. Mark, I mean,
there is actually,
but YouTube, not in terms of someone like Senna or, Prost or try and I don't want you to sell him as such to the audience, but I think try and give us a picture of what made him so.
He was just a phenomenal talent. He came in, he didn't even race cars before, he'd been racing motorbikes, and he was given a trial because the bike company that he was racing for was part of the same group of companies that under the Audi Union umbrella, and they were at the time running these monstrous V16 mid-engine things, which was totally different driving experience to anything else. And he came in and was instantly a sensation. He was leading his second Grand Prix, and a misfire meant he didn't win it. I think he won his fourth, and then he won the European Championship, which is equivalent to the World Championship the following year. He was just had an astonishing feel for a car, and was probably the quickest guy of his of an amazingly deep era. I mean, he was against Caracciola, Barzi, Novellari, just a fantastic depth of talent, and he came in from nowhere and instantly went to the front. And I think that is quite astonishing.
I was going to ask, actually, whether the depth of talent was as good in those days. I mean, there are, as you said, you mentioned a few names there who always spring to mind when you think of talent, but would you say the completely different eras, but was the depth of talent as deep then as it is now on the Formula One grid?
In the top half of the field, I'd say yes, it was. I think he used to fall off. It's more intense now. It's more intensely packed from front to back, I would say now. And this is even up the top end of a very, very good, generation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the depth that we've got today, because of the number of drivers coming through the junior formula, and the junior formula racing is actually very competitive now. I think the depth that you've got today is tremendous. But historically, if you look across the decades, the top half has always been strong, whether it's 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's the bottom half that I think has evolved and changed. Some decades have been stronger than others.
Right, some more names. I'm going to put one forward. Feel free to shout me down. Bernie Eccleston, I'm going to say. I know a lot of people are going to be shouting into in their cars, in their bedrooms. However, what he did, I'm thinking Bernie pre sort of late 90s, as Damien mentioned in the office. What he did for Formula One in terms of taking it from this kind of rough and ready sport into a global presence, in front of the world, basically, is unmatched, I would say. But there were a lot of arguments against before anyone starts putting letter bombs through my front door.
No, I think the only argument people could have against is the price of the tickets in the grandstands, which I agree is a big argument. But I think to counter that, people at home need to understand that in the last decade, that's been driven by CVC as much as Bernie. But I think I would agree with Bernie because A, he's a racer. He won world championships as a team boss. B, I think he professionalized the sport and made it, as you rightly said, into what it is today in many ways. He, in the 80s, had the vision to do it, made a lot of money along the way, but fair play. He was the only one who put his hand up and said, you know what, I'll have a go at this. Took his eye off the ball and eventually sold up Brabham because he knew he couldn't devote the time and energy required. I think he absolutely deserves to be in there.
I can hear people shouting from behind the microphone. Mark, could you agree with Bernie?
I think initially he was a power for the good, in how he transformed the sport. It wasn't great when he took over. And he also was, it's something that he doesn't get very much credit for, was very much behind the improvement in the safety standards. It was him that brought Sid Watkins on board. It was him that gave Sid the power to you know, make whatever changes were necessary. And the style of management, the benign dictator ideal that we were talking about before, he fitted that. Where I think his influence was less healthy was after he was given the keys to the sweet shop for the 100-year deal. And after that is what I was referring to before, where the sport got subverted by the business needs. That's so. I would say it checkered.
Yeah, there's two sides. Yeah. I think he's on there with a question mark at the moment. Let's have some more names. Karen,
I'm going to say Jean Todt. You know, today obviously known as the FIA president, but you know, if you look at the current situation at Ferrari, and Mark touched on it before, you know, it's quite complicated and messy, the situation they're in today, and I think there is no team that's harder to run than Ferrari, historically, if you look at it as a Formula One team. And he went in there in 1993, I think it was, in the summer of 93, having already won world championships and Le Mans with Peugeot and World Rally and sport, you know, and sports cars. And he got the job done. It took a while, but he created a period of dominance unlike any other we've seen in the sport. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Mark, I think we'd probably need at least four or five names. So thinking hats on, is there any that spring to mind? So one of the ones I thought of was Murray Walker for bringing Formula One into... hang on, before you write it up there. Sorry, there is a but. So it's for bringing Formula One into everyone's sitting rooms, living rooms, over generations, and bringing the sport alive and making the dullest race sounds actually extremely exciting. However, this year we are going to have a new award called the Motorsport Hall of Fame Trophy, which is such a struggle doing the rules and regulations. I've got to explain this now. Which will be for people who don't necessarily fit into particularly F1 or sports cars or US scene. So the likes of the rally drivers, touring car drivers, perhaps someone like Jonathan Palmer for keeping lots of British circuits alive. So I would say Murray Walker might fall into that. But then again, he was only F1, wasn't he? I mean, I know he loves his bikes.
Oh, no, he did all sorts. He was
touring cars, F3. I've got season review Formula 3s.
You know, it's Formula 1 that made him famous.
I think he'd be a worthy recipient of that award, yeah.
Yeah, the Motorsport Trophy. So leave him out of this for now.
Probably, yeah. Keep it simple.
I think it'd be unfair to compare him to the other people on that list.
To Bernie. So.
Well, or to the drivers or team bosses or other people. Yeah. So
okay, right. Some more names.
From the world of rallying, I'd like to put forward Henri Toivonen.
What, rallying?
Yeah.
That podcast isn't for another couple of months.
Can we not have a rally driver?
Well,
we
did some racing.
Come on, Dad. Did you not listen to the rules?
Yeah, no, but he did some racing and he's just fantastic. You should be in there.
We can't even write him up on the board. I knew this was going to be a struggle when we started. The good news is I think we are on course to deliver 12 names rather than...
Well, can
15,
I,
like we did last year.
Since he's clearly still thinking, I'm going to throw in another modern one who it's just popped in my head and I talked about before. It's actually Paddy Lowe, because I think he's won world championships now with Williams, with McLaren, and now with Mercedes. And, you know, actually been very involved at a very senior level in periods of dominance for all three of these teams. And I think... In the same way that you've got Newey up there, I think Paddy deserves something.
Yeah, no, good call.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay, so I think Lowe is should be on there. So something I didn't actually say in all the rules and regulations, one of which is called the Simon Aaron rule. Try not to make anything too left field, because last year I think five of his suggestions made it into the final ones, and they got a single figure vote. You have been warned. The last rule is, if someone is very current, I know Rossi and Loeb were in this year, we're going to try and, if likes of Hamilton, Vettel, they are absolutely worthy of the Hall of Fame, but I don't think their time is now, as it were.
How about a driver on sabbatical?
Okay, I think there is a chink in the armor of the rules there. Are you thinking of Button by any chance?
I'm just asking the steward of the meeting.
I can't believe I'm the steward. It's the, you know, you were talking about amateur, unqualified stewards. Well, here we go. I think Button is valid because he has now stepped down for the time being.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jensen, in the same way, I put him in a similar category to Damon Hill, an underrated world champion. I think Jensen has, he hasn't got the last tenth of a second that a Lewis may have, and he's actually quite freely and readily admits that. I saw an interview of his with Murray Walker on Saturday that he did, and he was quite open about it, surprisingly so. But he's driven some great races, won a lot of good races. He's a world champion, of course. So I think he's... I'm just going to throw his name into the hat and see where he ends up.
Yeah, okay. Any more rally drivers, Mark? Or have you got some Formula One names to put forward?
Well, I put Carlos Sainz now.
Junior.
Well, should we try and cross some off?
I have a question. Did John Barnard never come up in discussion?
That's a very good question.
That's actually a very good point. No, that's a good call.
Yeah, you should definitely be in there.
Well, he
innovatively came up with the idea of a carbon chassis. And I tell you what, having crashed a carbon chassis on more than one occasion, I thank him quite often. You know, the safety standards of the modern carbon fiber monocoque in a race car are tremendous. Fair play to Ron Dennis for allowing him to pursue that. But, you know, tremendous success in the 80s.
And then went on the paddle shift, that was him.
That was the next thing, wasn't it? Ferrari.
Yeah. Two major advances in F1 technology, both his.
Was he behind it was the 89 Ferrari, wasn't it? The paddle shift car. I mean, it's still one of the most beautiful Formula One cars.
His cars were always very beautiful.
Stunning.
Very elegant. Yeah.
He should be in just for that, I think, making beautiful F1 cars. But he was an innovator as well as a designer, wasn't he? A bit like in the Newey mold or Gordon Murray.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. I think he should get a square around him.
How come Hakkinen was a question mark last year?
He would say he was very much in the pot for people to vote on, but he did not get as many votes as the likes of Mansell, Villeneuve and Cosworth.
I'm a little bit surprised with that. Because he rocked up at McLaren, now qualified Senna, first time out. And actually now, when you look back in hindsight, that period of Schumacher, Ferrari, I know you really had two real rivals. One was Damon and one was Mika. And, you know, Mika's the only one who, towards, that period where Ferrari were getting really strong, I think they... on a week-by-week basis, they were genuinely worried about him. And I think, I'm a massive Hakkinen fan. I think he, just for raw speed and being quite... He wasn't political. He wasn't, didn't play the games. Just got on with it. I still have the season review of the 1990 Formula 3 season. It was him versus Mika Salo.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic season. It's brilliant racing. I would say Mika Hakkinen deserves something.
It was Macau that year where his rivalry with Schumacher really started, wasn't it?
And then boiled over.
Yeah.
Well, would you disagree with any of that?
Mark? No, I wouldn't. No. Okay, in fact, when I did an interview once with Jock Clear, who was working with Michael second time around, in his Mercedes career, and they'd obviously had many good chats because he used to be the enemy in the other camp, and he was saying that Michael had told him that the reason why he was so all-encompassing in his approach, the way he had to have every box ticked off and had to think so outside the box, was, as he explained it, he said, I can't drive a racing car as fast as Mika Hakkinen, so I have to beat him in other ways, which was quite a revealing thing that even he thought that.
Yeah, that's amazing. For that alone, I think you should have a rectangle around him. Okay, so to Piquet, I think I think
for Piquet.
Yeah, Piquet.
Yeah,
should
I can't
absolutely
put up any arguments against him.
Any more from Hawthorn up?
So we need three more, don't
well,
we?
Well, yeah, so we got how many? Yeah, we got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, so three more.
Are we a question mark on Todd, or what are we thinking? What are your views, both of you?
Peterson, should we tackle him first? What do we think?
Well, I nominated him, so you
yeah, that's a fair point. You also nominated Toivonen, though, so...
Yeah, but you wouldn't let me have him, so I'm having the most rally driver-like racing driver I could think of.
Peterson.
I mean, Peterson and Rindt are both very worthy candidates, I think, to be in there. I mean, you know, I think Peterson, obviously, very, very quick, but I think people who go into the Hall of Fame and need to be a bit different. They need to be characters.
It's not just about stats.
You know, it's about being, and I think, you know, Peterson showed his loyalty in his year with Andretti, you know, played the team player very well, great character in that respect. And
he's
also
a bit of a folk hero with the crowds just because of how dramatic he was.
I was about to say, in a way that, you know, I would think of someone like John Alesi, you know, only won one Grand Prix, God knows how. But, you know, if you look at his F3000 record and the way he arrived in F1, you'd think that bloke's going to win 5 world championships. But to me, he's somebody as well. And Peterson is sort of like that, isn't he? He really had this appeal with the fans because of his style, I think. So I would say yes to Peterson.
Okay. I'm just going to throw another name in the hat. The stats lying sometimes brought it to mind. Chris Amon, what are our thoughts? Because some people say he was...
he wasn't very lucky.
He wasn't... No, as Mario Andretti said, if he was an undertaker, people would stop dying. It's arguably one of the fastest drivers out there, but just...
Totally.
And spectacular. And there's that, obviously that photo of him on opposite lock at Alton Park, which is just one of the greatest.
Yeah, just one of the great natural talents of all time. Just a fabulous driver. Made some questionable career choices that really sort of didn't let that translate. But when he was in probably the most competitive car he had over the season was 68, and he should have won the World Championship that year, and it was no fault of his that he didn't.
Okay.
Very much in our minds at the moment as well.
Did he lose the race once because he tried to pull off a tear off and pulled his visor off? So I read that.
Yes.
Who loses the race because of that? Yeah. You know, it's just so unfortunate and unlucky. I would agree. I'm not sure if I'd have him over having Rindt. But
I'll tell you what, we can make a deal. How about Rindt and Amon?
And no Todd.
And no Todd.
So we got to throw one of those three out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Six.
I think what Todd achieved at in sports cars, rallying, Ferrari especially, is absolutely amazing. But he was part of a core team there, Braun, Schumacher.
But he pulled them together, didn't he?
And I mean, it's hard to argue.
But then also FIA president. Has he been a great FIA president, would you say?
Not yet. I think time will tell. Yeah. You can only look back when his term is finished. I think, you know, when you're in it, there's too many divisive issues going on. I don't think it's fair to judge. But I just look at how difficult it is to run Ferrari, or must be to run Formula One team.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm going to say yes to Todd.
How about we swap Todd and Lowe? Because Paddy's still very much involved in the sport. He's still very high up in Mercedes. He's still achieving now. So going by that rationale, the rationale of not including the likes of Hamilton and Vettel, should he? I know up here we have quite a few names that are still.
Newey's retired. People would hope Newey's retired before the 17 and aero rules come out, but I don't think so.
Thoughts on that? Swapping Todd for Lowe. I feel as I'm actually doing some kind of business deal here.
Let's leave Rindt out because he didn't. You know, he didn't make it last year.
And try with someone like
Amon and Todd. I think we should have Todd and Chris Amon in, because
I could settle on that. I could live with that.
Yeah.
No, Bernie. No, it's too divisive, I have to say. I'll never hear the end of it. So Todd and Amon, I think. So that does that now make 12?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There we go. Is anyone on that list that jumps out that should be in or shouldn't be in?
Only Tyburn.
He wants to be invited back to the rally podcast.
We'll get you back for the rally podcast, I think.
How many rallies he's been to, but...
Maybe next year for Toivonen in the Formula 1 category. Karen, anyone, before we call an end to this nightmare of rules and regulations, anyone that's missing or anything that jumps out that shouldn't be there?
Well...
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
In many ways, I think like you had Hill and Hill and you've got Cosworth. I think, you know, Frank and Patrick should have gone together. I'd like to see Patrick back on another list because, especially in 86, you know, after Frank's accident, it would have been very easy for the team to fold up and go. And Patrick really steered the ship and they won the world championship that, you know, as constructors and then won the following year in 87 with dominance, really. So,
and you were talking earlier on about characters and he's certainly a massive character, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, that's one that I hope gets included again next year.
Yeah, absolutely. All the names that have been left off can be put back in next year. So Jack, thank you so much for all your help on that one. Karen, thank you so much for all the insight on current F1 and giving all the answers to the readers' questions. Mark, thank you so much for suggesting Henri Toivonen for the Formula 1 category and for all your insight into the modern world of Formula 1. We will see you all in a month or two for the sports car category Hall of Fame podcast. We'll see you all then. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.